If you missed the tribute to Christopher Hogwood on yesterday's Music Matters, it's available on the iPlayer now. And Lucy Skeeping, along with Sir Nicholas Kenyon, will be remembering him on the Early Music Show this afternoon with a number of his recordings. Well, that's just about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. Thank you so much for your company. I do hope you've enjoyed today's selection of music. Next week, the Couperin family makes its presence felt between 10 and 11. Leon Fleischer plays Schubert's Wanderer Fantasy, and my 20th century violin concerto is by Sergei Prokofiev, his second in a recording that in my book has never been bettered. Yasha Heifetz with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Munch. So that's the same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
In a three-part series on BBC Radio 3, I'll be setting out to measure the impact of the new global passion for Western classical music.
We were in Beijing in March. That performance was compared with two of the Europe's top orchestras.
I'm Petrarch Trelawney, and in tonight's programme, I'll be focusing on the orchestra. Orchestras in Guangzhou, Hong Kong, Qatar and Sao Paulo.
Sao Paulo particularly is right in the middle of an intellectual and, I think, emotional blossoming. It's so exciting to be there.
The Sunday feature, Global Classical Music, A New World Symphony. Tonight at 6:45 on BBC Radio 3.
We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM, we're on DAB digital radio, and we're live online in HD sound. It's just gone midday, and now Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest today is Charles Spencer, historian and brother of Diana, Princess of Wales.
Charles Spencer, the 9th Earl Spencer, has had a successful career as a television reporter and presenter, and since his sister Diana's death, has turned to writing history. His latest book tackles the startling subject of regicide, with the title Killers of the King. The king in question is Charles I, and the book follows the fortunes of those who were responsible for his execution. I couldn't help wondering, Charles, which side the Spencer family were on in the Civil War. I mean, were they rebels?
Well, we were reluctant royalists, I think would be the right expression. So all the way up until the actual war broke, we were against Charles I. And then I think my ancestor, judging from his letters, felt that he couldn't possibly draw his sword against his king, and then served in a minor way in the Civil War before being killed at the First Battle of Newbury.
When you first started writing history, Charles, your focus was on the Spencer family and Ulltrop, the stately home you inherited in Northamptonshire. And that was back in 1998, the year after Diana's death. And I wonder what it was that drew you to history, and whether perhaps in some way you had a new sense of just how important family is.
Well, I think I had taken over the house a few years earlier, and actually, as a young boy, I was a tour guide at Ulltrop. So I'd got to know the portraits, many of which are family. And so I knew the stories behind the paintings. These were real people. And yes, the women were painted at their most beautiful and the men at their most powerful, but they were fundamentally human beings, and they were connected to me by blood, I suppose. And a very long time ago, I was taken aside by a senior journalist, and he said, listen, there's only three stories people are interested in when they're watching one of your reports, and that is if they can say, hey, that's me, hey, I wish that was me, or hey, I'm glad that's not me. Well, my story is very much, hey, I'm glad that's not me, because they're being pursued for their lives around the globe.
When you're writing, whether it's journalism or history, I think you quite like to have music on in the background, don't you?
Oh, it's huge to me. I believe my brain is, I'm not sure what the actual type is, but I need the distraction. So every time I've written a book, I've had a different piece of music bound up with that book forever in my memory, because it's the one that I played in the background as I did the research.
Well, in this instance, It's a very famous piece of music, isn't it?
Well, I must apologise to your more sophisticated audience for the fact that it is actually a musical cliché. But you know what? For something as dramatic as the killing of Charles I and the hunting down of his men, I make no excuse for having chosen Beethoven's Symphony No. 5.
Well, I don't think you need to make an excuse anyway, because it is such a marvellous piece and such a gripping piece, and a piece that's had a huge role in history. I mean, I'm thinking of the way the BBC used the opening during the Second World War to identify various signals they were sending. I think it's only actually the fourth time in the history of the programme we've had it. So
you're setting the record straight.
But it is one of the 10 pieces that's been chosen by the BBC to inspire primary school children to listen to more classical music. And I guess you'd think it was a good choice for that.
I think so. I think it's incredibly accessible, but in the right sort of way. I'm not being condescending. I think it grabs you from the first moment and pulls you in, and the urgency is there, and then it obviously widens out into this magnificent piece. But I defy any school child not to react to this. Thank you.
That was quite a quick performance, but it was an exciting one, I thought.
And that, to me, is what that's about. You know, it's about raw passion. It's a very masculine piece, I think, as well. And it's full of energy.
Yeah. The first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, with Paavo Järvi conducting the Bremen German Chamber Philharmonic. And you can hear the whole of that symphony in a performance by the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Gianandrea Noseda, tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Radio 3, and you can compare the tempi. So I can't help feeling, Earl Spencer, that in this book there's an element about some of the people you're writing about which perhaps you yourself were surprised to find that you started admiring them.
Well, you're absolutely right, Michael, because to be honest, when I started the book, well, before I really started researching deeply, I thought I was going to side very dramatically with Charles I and then see these interesting men come up with a flawed method of dealing with a problem by killing a king. But actually, I ended up by the end realizing that I was dealing with a series of very brave men. Charles I, we know, was incredibly noble and chivalrous and decent at his end, and suffered in a way that only helped his cause. He left this legacy of a Christ-like martyr, which gave his supporters a lot of encouragement and hope for the future. But then I realized that these men who put him to death, yes, there were one or two committed, what we would consider political republicans, who just wanted a king out the way. But most of them were dealing with incredibly heartfelt, sincere passions. And they believed they were doing the right thing for their country and for their God. And really, there was nothing more important in the 17th century mind than doing those two things. So they did the right thing in their code. Now, we can look back and think, well, some of their religious beliefs were clearly wrong. We know that because, well, some of them, a lot of them believed that Christ was going to reappear in 1666. So at least we know that's wrong. But they believed that they had to get on with preparing the way for the Lord's second coming, and getting the bloodshed of Great Britain put to bed was part of their job on earth. And so they did what they did with a pure heart.
Did it bring out an element of the Republican in you? all of this?
Well, I'm afraid it sort of did, in a way. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself Republican, but you become very clear through the views of others, beautifully put. You can see both sides of the argument very clearly. So I respected the Republicanism in those that had it. But I also respected those who still believed in a monarchy being the cornerstone of British society. And I also, this was not an intention of most of the regicides, but they helped to fashion a way in which we have our constitutional monarchy now by taking down what was a, I think, a very wrong medieval monarchy. They made it possible for monarchy in its better form to survive.
Well, what you're saying, in a sense, is that you can be a Republican or a Royalist and you can still be very patriotic. And
yes,
actually,
that's
true. Takes us rather nicely to this next piece of music, which is all about patriotism in music. Finlandia by Sibelius. It's almost like a kind of theme tune for Finland, isn't it?
Yes, I was lucky enough to visit Finland as a teenager, just by chance, having watched a Peter Ustinov programme on Leningrad. I got a train from Finland into Leningrad, and I couldn't believe the beauty of Finland, and it does come through in this wonderful piece.
Sibelius's Finlandia with Osmo Vanska conducting the Lahti Symphony Orchestra. Your next choice, Charles, takes you back to childhood. And it wasn't an entirely easy childhood, was it?
No, it was quite a testing one, I think. I mean, obviously privileged in material terms, but quite fraught, actually. You know, my mother left home when we were very young. I mean, I was two, I think. And in those days, I don't think people were very good at dealing with all of this sort of thing. So we were given all sorts of reasons why she wasn't around. And even as a 3 or 4 year old, you realise these are not entirely true reasons. And my mother went to live in Australia for quite a long time with her to-be second husband. I didn't know there was another man around at all. And I met him on their wedding day. They just got married. So, you know, quite disruptive. My father did a great job trying to sort of keep it all together, really. But no, it was quite difficult, I think, because of the sort of upper class dishonesty about it all. This not wanting to deal with emotions when, of course, children are all about emotions.
You and Diana, who was 3 years older, both yeah. had to endure quite long train journeys, didn't you, between
yes.
your parents' homes at weekends?
Yes, there was a very unpleasant court case, etc. And at the end of the day, the judge gave custody to my father. So there were 5 of us to start with, and I had a brother who was older than me, who I actually never met, who died, and he was the one in the middle. So we ended up growing up, I think, the 2 elder sisters as one unit, and then Diana and I as another unit. And so, yes, we used to, I think it was every 4 weeks, we used to get on the train from King's Lynn in Norfolk and go to Liverpool Street in London and spend a night with my mother. You know, I can remember every station's name. And it was, in those days, a very long journey each way, just for one night in London. And the whole thing was quite difficult, really.
Did this separation from particularly your mother, I mean, did it bind you and Diana together quite closely?
Yeah, very much. And I remember in the eulogy to Diana, I did talk about her sort of, well, not only the train journeys, but also her looking after me. And she had a very strong maternal streak, if that's appropriate in a young child, but she was very loving and she used to, I mean, I used to be terrified of the dark and all sorts of things, and she used to say that it used to break her heart to hear me crying down the corridor and things. And I think she was a very reassuring female presence in my early life.
Now, this choice that you've made next is a really interesting one, and for many reasons. It's to do with history, mm-hmm. and it's to do with an event that shocked the world, really. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I stumbled across this, and it reminded me. I do remember, I was only 4 at the time, Martin Luther King dying. And I can't say I remember this speech, but I was in the Kennedy Memorial outside of Boston and listen to this speech given by a brilliant speaker, Robert F. Kennedy, I mean, who I think was the better speaker of the Kennedy brothers. And it's the most remarkable thing, because even though I think he did have a little time to prepare, it seems like the most magnificent extemporizing. And I think actually, as you listen to it, you'll realize that he is leading from one thought to the other. And however he prepared, actually, when he gave the speech, it feels to me that he's leaping off one thought into the other one with huge aplomb. You know, having given a eulogy in a rather similar circumstance, I think that one of the things you have to do as the giver of a eulogy is to tap into what more than you yourself are feeling. And Robert F. Kennedy, by getting the hugeness of the assassination of Martin Luther King and realizing the ramifications for America through the death of the most prominent black member of society, I think he captures it so well and judges the mood so perfectly, and there isn't a phrase out of place.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm only going to talk to you just for a minute or so this evening because I have some very sad news for all of you. And I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own day despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Robert F. Kennedy's moving speech just after the assassination of Martin Luther King on the 4th of April, 1968. And of course, you could hear that great gasp of shock and pain in the crowd there at the beginning of that news footage. Do you think from your own experiences that Aeschylus is right, that one can take wisdom from pain? That one must, perhaps?
Well, I think you're right. It's more must, because there's pain is what it is, but there's no point in taking anything except a lesson from it, because otherwise you've just been defeated.
Without going into the specifics, it must be very extraordinary for a historian, somebody who studied history, to find yourself at the epicentre of history after the death of Diana.
Yes, I should explain that from the moment my sister Diana became a piece of public property, as it were, I had a dual relationship with her, one as a person who was my sister and one as the person who was written about or broadcast about. So as somebody interested in history at the time, I found that fascinating, because soon after she got married, I would turn on the radio and listen to the news. I was absolutely petrified that, for instance, she was going to be blown up by the IRA or something, you know. So my sister had been taken into a public sphere where it was more dangerous, it was more fraught and away from a family context. So really, her death was the summation of that, because we as a family had to mourn the loss of somebody we had grown up with or lived with, etc. And at the same time, realised that the grieving was much wider than that, and of course encompassed many millions of people who had never met her, but to whom she meant a lot.
Does it help to know that there's a huge outpouring of affection and grieving?
Well, I remember at the time thinking how immensely sad that aspect was, because I think because towards the end of her life, Diana was very much a sort of tabloid punch bag. She wouldn't have known how loved she was. So, and it would have meant a lot to her. She was somebody who craved love, as we all do, but, you know, and she did. And
that, of course, that craving for love often makes one very vulnerable.
Absolutely right. Yes, it does. And of course, when you're presented with the opposite of love, which is sharp criticism or whatever, it doesn't sit easily.
Next, another memory from childhood, actually. And yes. I think this is music, which probably will make you feel just a little bit nervous when you listen to it.
Well, you're so right. I mean, I felt incredibly nervous at the time. So I went to a smallish prep school in Northamptonshire called Maidwell Hall. And I was one of the choristers, and then the main chorister lost his voice a little while before the carol service. And so the choir master said, well, you're going to have to do the solo. And at the time, I was a very, very shy boy, actually, and it filled me with dread, and I, actually to the point of feeling faint. And then eventually it got to a very difficult stage, actually. I mean, not to harp on about my family background, but my parents took turns to come and see things at sports matches or whatever, and somehow it was the turn of my mother to go to the next thing, and my father reluctantly sort of conceded, and I sang this this verse, and actually never have I been more grateful for reinforcements when the altos came in sort of halfway through. But there was this sort of, it's one of these sort of snapshots of youth as I sat down, so relieved to have got through it and not to have made sort of terrible mistakes. And then about a minute later, the church door opened and my mother arrived. And that was a real, I remember thinking at the time, well, my father wouldn't have been late. And it was one of those moments. But at the end of the day, when I think about this piece, it's about, goodness, that was a big challenge. And
but luckily, actually, that is a very telling story psychologically for a child, isn't it?
Well, it is actually, because it's all about, I think as a father, I'm a father of, remarkably these days, of 7 children, and I know you sort of learn what's important.
Thank you.
Once in Royal David City, Stephen Clebury conducting the choir of King's College, Cambridge. And that reminds my guest Charles Spencer of his first big solo in a church. An even more public one was to follow. The choir boy soloist there was Robin Barter. Despite coming from, as you yourself said, a privileged and in many ways conventional childhood, unconventional in others, you are actually quite a rebel in many ways. I mean, you dared to get up and say what you thought in a very public arena. And interestingly, despite Eton and Oxford and all of those things and the title, you actually opted for a rather unconventional career, didn't you?
Yes.
A news reporter for American television. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, I'd worked for a record company, talent spotting in my sort of time off at Oxford in a holiday. And then the boss of that company said, you should do television. And I hadn't thought about it. And I had looked at various careers, none of which really appealed. And then this opportunity came along in 1986 to become a sort of guest commentator at Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's wedding. And I sort of rolled up and it went OK. And then the executive producer said to me, you've got a job. And I said, oh, sorry, what do you mean? He said, well, if you want to have a job, you can join us. So we were at a party celebrating the end of the broadcast. So I wrote out on a napkin a contract. And I asked him to sign it, and he laughed, thinking he'd never see me again. So I then turned up in his office in New York and said, well, I'd love that job, and produced the napkin. And out of that came a very small job for 1 year, and then I stayed there pretty much for a decade, starting with very undemanding British-type things. But then, you know, I was covering the plight of the poor in Asia and all sorts of different things. But one of the first things that took me away from the conventional English things was a light week covering the Cannes Film Festival. That was the first break I had between being this very traditional English boy who had been taken on as a sort of bit of a gimmick by NBC to what became a much broader and richer career as a journalist.
And I think this music conjures up for you that time.
So this piece was what we used to cut the first report I did on the Cannes Film Festival to, and it's not an original piece. They had to have something French and accessible, and so I chose La Vie en Rose.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots tous les jours, que ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie. Des nuits d'amour à plus finir, un grand bonheur qui prend sa place, des ennuis, des chagrins s'effacent, heureux, heureux à en mourir. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause.
Edith Piaf with La Vie en Rose, recorded in 1946. You gave up much of that travelling as a news reporter, Charles, soon after you inherited the family house at Althorp in Northamptonshire. Yes. I think you were only about 27, and here was this 500-year-old house, Deer Park, 13,000 acres, God knows how many rooms. It's a huge challenge, and I suppose it does take over your life at that point.
The funny thing about running a historic house and an estate is that it's really not intellectually demanding, but it's very time-consuming. There's an awful lot of people who believe they must have your time, and they're right. You know, it does need a lot of attention. So I had to channel everything in a different direction, and writing came along at just the right time. And the joy of writing for me is I can fit it in around everything else, and it works.
And you still find treasures in the attic.
Yes. I found all sorts of things. While I've been there, I found a handwritten receipt from Sir Joshua Reynolds for one of our portraits. And it's really never-ending. And I found, actually, the other day, a year or so ago, I was studying one of the regicides, who is a character in my book. But I went on Wikipedia and into the Dictionary of National Biography and all this, and there's one portrait of him they had. And nobody knew where it was. And I just happened to be, I mean, it sounds ridiculous. I was walking up the main staircase at Althorp, and there he was, the portrait of this, you know, lesser figure in the book. But it just shows in a house with that depth of context, there's no end to what it throws up.
And one of your innovations has been to start a literary festival at Althorp.
Yes.
And it's unusual that the visiting writers actually get to stay at the house.
Yes, well, this is very important for me. I've done the rounds and will soon be doing them again of the literary festivals. And lovely though they are, often there's this awkward moment. You've given your speech, they're thrilled you've turned up because there's no embarrassment that there's a vacant slot. Then you sign the books, and then the organiser says, would you like a cup of tea before you go? With the emphasis that there's the door. And I thought, well, actually, these poor authors, you know, they're selling what they love, which is the book they've worked on for a very long time. And they're all very interesting people. And so why not throw them together? And it's almost going back to the old idea of a salon. And you put them together and it's very relaxed and they meet each other over dinner and they spend the evening together and they all tend to enjoy it.
There was, though, Charles, wasn't there, a period when you actually left Althorp to move to South Africa during your first marriage. And maybe that was also partially to do with the extraordinarily intrusive press interest in you.
Well, that was why I moved there, really. I mean, my life was becoming intolerable over here and my children were suffering and I just thought, let's give them 5 years where they can just be themselves. That was the initial idea. And South Africa, I had been posted in Johannesburg for NBC for a while, so I knew how beautiful it was and how child-centric it was. But of course, there's a darker side, and it's the poverty and it's the violence and all of that, and you can't be shielded against that. And it's amazing how many people I knew in South Africa who suffered terribly and some died. And the reason I chose the next piece of music was really a coming together of all of those points, where I got to know this wonderful man, very talented, Dion van der Walt, who was South Africa's greatest opera singer at the time, whose real passion, apart from music, was wine. And he had a beautiful vineyard in Paarl outside of Cape Town. And one of the happiest evenings I spent in my years in South Africa was in his wine cellar. And he appeared and he had put a piano in there with an accompanist and he sang some of his favourite pieces of music while we sampled his
favourite
bottles. And that was a really wonderful way to go. But very sadly, Dion was murdered by his own father in a terrible family row, which sort of sums up, to me, this sums up the joy of South Africa and also the dark violence, really.
Well, you've chosen Tamino's aria from The Magic Flute.
Yes.
And the young prince is gazing at the portrait of the beautiful princess he is yet to meet. I cannot name my feeling, he sings, so I feel it burn like fire within me. Could this feeling be love?
Bezaubernd schön. Mein Herz.
Deon van de Valt singing Tamino's aria from Act One of The Magic Flute, with Ralph Feiker conducting the Munich Radio Orchestra. A great aria of romantic longing. And talking of that, you were saying how much you delight Charles Spencer in your seven children, aging from upwards, or aging downwards from 23 down to two. And they come from three marriages, don't they?
They do. In fact, it's 4, 2, and 1. And, I mean, the real joy for me is I've also got two stepdaughters in their teens, which fill in the blank age-wise. So I've literally got everything covered between 2 and 23. But the real joy to me, Michael, is that, you know, obviously one doesn't want the trauma of divorce on one's children and all of that. But the children get on incredibly well, all nine of them. And we have carved out, my wife Karen is very, very family orientated, and we've carved out a 10-day period in every summer and a week every Christmas or just before Christmas, depending on the year, where we all get together. And it's so lovely, you know. And I love my 2-year-old, her Chinese astrology chart has her down as the unifier. And it is quite bizarre that she has taken on this role, because really, wherever she goes, there are adoring siblings who hold her and love her. And she, by the way, I worry about her future, because she just thinks life is so remarkably easy. So going everywhere and being adored. But no, I'm very lucky. And given that nobody would wish divorce on anyone, but it's worked out incredibly well given the circumstances.
So fatherhood is in many ways what really matters to you.
It does. And actually, I find the older that I get, the more I feel that. And I've always felt intensely sort of, like a sort of tiger wanting to fight for my children. But at the same time, as I turned 50 in May, there's a sort of patriarch role that I really like. And I'm not rushing any of my elder daughters, but I look forward to being a grandfather, etc. I do think family is the cornerstone. Ironic though that sounds from a double divorcee.
Well, it's rather nice in that case that we're going to end with music that reminds you of your own father, yes. The Sanctus from the Vorrei Requiem.
Yes, I wanted to connect the generations in my family, and I'm glad that you've placed this at the end, really, because it unifies everything. And it was my first marriage, which was 25 years ago this month, this September. And during it, I was lucky enough to have some musicians play, etc. And when they played this piece, The Sanctus from Vorrei Requiem, I just remember my father being reduced to sort of really major emotion, actually, as he looked on at his son getting married. And I see this as the soundtrack to a marriage that produced 4 children, and 4 wonderful children, all in their 20s now, and how very much my father would have loved them if he had known more than one of them.
Well, Charles Spencer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Sanctus from Faure's Requiem, with Jean Fournet conducting the Netherlands Radio Chorus and Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra. Michael Barclay's guest on today's Private Passions was Charles Spencer. And you can download a podcast of that programme and others in the series if you go to the Radio 3 website and just click on programmes. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. And next week, Michael Barclay's guest is the singer Joan Armour Trading. That's next Sunday at midday.
Every night here on BBC Radio 3, Live in Concert brings you an inspiring and diverse range of music.
Here is Thomas Sondergaard.
From Bach to surrealist ballet music, Beethoven to Strauss, share the exhilarating experience of a live concert atmosphere with performances from up and down the country. And don't worry if you miss the music as it happens, because you can relive every concert for 30 days via the Radio 3 website. There's a wealth of great music to enjoy.
The end of Schumann's Symphony No. 2 in C major.
So take your seat for Live in Concert tomorrow evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, if you've recently tuned in this Sunday lunchtime, a warm welcome to you from me, Jonathan Swain. In a couple of minutes, another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert from London's Wigmore Hall. Songs by Aaron Copland, Benjamin Britten and Kurt Weill. First, though, at 1 minute past one, the BBC News. The Prime Minister has conceded that the Conservatives have not had the ideal start to their last conference before the general election. As Tory delegates gathered in Birmingham, they were digesting the news that a minister had resigned after sending an explicit picture to an undercover reporter posing as a female activist. Brooks Newmark admitted that he was a complete fool and had no one to blame but himself. A second Conservative MP, Mark Reckless, has defected to UKIP, accusing the government of failing to keep its promises on Europe, the economy and immigration. This morning, David Cameron called his departure senseless and counterproductive. The RAF has been flying more missions over Iraq. The Tornado jets, based in Cyprus, gathered information on IS jihadists, but didn't mount any attacks. The Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, has said Islamic State forces are now under pressure, and the US valued the British involvement. Police in Hong Kong have fired tear gas to clear protesters from outside government buildings where tens of thousands of pro-democracy activists have taken to the streets. Hong Kong's chief executive, CY Leung, has declared the occupation of parts of the city unlawful. The demonstrators say China is not letting them freely choose their next leader. An erupting volcano in Japan is feared to have killed at least 30 hikers. Rescuers found the bodies near the top of Mount Ontake, which is a popular climbing destination in central Japan. At least 250 people were initially trapped on the slopes, though most of them have made their way down safely. The Kenyan long-distance runner Dennis Kimeto has smashed the marathon world record in Berlin. The 30-year-old finished in 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds, 26 seconds faster than the previous record. And finally, David Cameron has told the BBC that he is extremely sorry and very embarrassed about being overheard saying the Queen purred when told the No campaign had won the Scottish independence referendum. Mr Cameron said he was not going to discuss his conversations with the palace ever again. And the weather, another largely dry day. It'll be warm in the south, but cloudy in the northwest with occasional rain. And that's the BBC News and Weather at a little after 3 minutes past one. And so to the Radio 3 lunchtime concert. It was first broadcast live last Monday lunchtime from Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall. Today's Radio 3 lunchtime concert features Califax, the reed quintet from the Netherlands who've been going for nearly 30 years and are wonderfully creative musicians full of personality. Rather than playing music that already exists for wind quintet, they tend to arrange everything themselves, and they take in repertoire from the keyboard music of Rameau to what we're hearing today, a sequence of music paying homage to the Roaring Twenties, Europe and America gripped by jazz fever, and in the aftermath of World War I, dance halls and cinemas springing up in cultural rehabilitation. The Califax Quintet are joined today by the Dutch mezzo Cora Burgraf for some cabaret songs by Kurt Weill and Benjamin Britten, and they're also going to play their own arrangement of George Gershwin's orchestral American in Paris. But they're starting off with A Sentimental Melody by Aaron Copland, a slow dance, one of his four blues melodies written in 1926. Here they are, very dapper in pinstripe suits, the Califax Reed Quintet, to start their recital with Copland. Charming start to Califax's recital here at Wigmore Hall. And here comes the mezzo, Cora Burggraf, in a white sequined flapper dress to sing Britain's cabaret songs.